Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is The Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Tom Roddy. And of course, both of you join us after a very hectic Sunday, the final Sunday of the 2019-2020 Premier League season. So, Tom, where were you?
I was at Southampton, seeing Danny Ings come within one of the golden boot, and took Shay Adams 30 games to score for Southampton, and now he can't stop. So, it was sort of a summary of their season, in that they started really badly and ended strongly. Yeah, it was good fun.
Just briefly, for Southampton fans that might be listening, how optimistic could they be and should they be for next season?
I think big time. I've always admired Ralph Hasenhüttl. I think he's a brilliant coach. I think the concern is, like most Premier League clubs who are at, sort of outside the top six, will be traditional top six will be this summer. It's what happens to your squad. One of the things I've noticed listening to Hasenhüttl quite a lot, especially since the restart, is he's asked about individual players and he doesn't particularly like talking about them. He's not as sort of effusive as you'd expect him to be. And I think he did admit part of the reason is that he doesn't want to draw too much attention. I mean, you've got a striker like Danny Ings playing for Southampton, who's scored 23 goals this year. You've got Ryan Bertrand, who's been brilliant at left back. I mean, could have been, if it wasn't for the sort of the amount of talent England have got at left back, he could be in that. He could be in contention for that as well. And of course, Højbjerg's already going, or looks like he's going. So I think they just don't want to see it stripped apart again.
And Gregor, while Tom was on the South Coast, I know you were covering a game, but it wasn't in the Premier League. Where were you? What were you doing? What did you make of it?
I was at Swansea Brentford. I was seeing all the results in the Premier League come through on my phone beforehand, and certainly looked like a thrilling one, particularly Villa West Ham, my God. But then, yes, I was at Swansea Brentford, the first leg of the Championship playoff semi-final, which was an eventful game too. There was a very contentious red card, and it was basically a crazy two-minute spell in the midway through the second half when Swansea missed a penalty, and then almost immediately afterwards, Brentford's Rico Henry, the left-back, was sent off for what looked like a perfectly good tackle. And Keith Stroud was in the crosshairs after that, and Thomas Frank had some interesting things to say as well. So, yeah, you know all this. I'm talking, preaching to the converted.
I'll tell you what, if people don't know Thomas Frank and his character, you only had to see him post-match. He was fiery, wasn't he?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there were some lines that you couldn't insert in a respectable newspaper, yeah. So, no, interesting second leg ahead, though, definitely.
Yeah, one goal in its Swansea lead as they take that to Griffin Park on Wednesday night. Now, we've got loads coming up as the curtain closes on the longest ever Premier League campaign. 352 days of it, to be precise. We're going to break down the best of the final day action as Aston Villa avoided the drop, and we'll pick our moments of the season. First, though, we're talking about the top four.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The champions Liverpool and Manchester City had already booked their places in next season's Champions League going into the final day of the Premier League season. So that left two places with three teams to battle it out: Manchester United, Chelsea and Leicester. United and Chelsea came out on top, finishing third and fourth. And that meant Brendan Rodgers' Leicester side were the ones to miss out after spending 312 consecutive days in the top four this season. A 2-0 win against Wolves sealed a fourth place finish for Frank Lampard in his first season in charge, which is not bad for a rookie who had lost Eden Hazard before he'd picked a team. Manchester United, however, had been 14 points behind Leicester City in February, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer never lost faith. Last week, they jumped above Leicester before sealing the deal against the Foxes on the final day with another 2-0 win. So let's take a look back at Solskjaer's first full season and then, of course, Frank Lampard's first season at United and Chelsea, respectively. Tom, how would you assess both those managers' first season at the clubs where they became legends as players, first full season?
The general feeling seems to be that Lampard has done a slightly better job than Solskjaer. And that's possibly down to the context that was always going to come at Chelsea, regardless of where they finished at the end of the season. It's whenever you hear anyone talk about Chelsea these days, the three things come before it, which is talk of the kids coming through, the transfer ban, and of course, the loss of Eden Hazard. And I think even if it had gone catastrophically, I think Lampard might have been given a bit of slack. But at the same time, that context goes towards elevating the achievement of getting fourth. I mean, I think he's spoken a lot before this last game of the season when fourth wasn't certain. He spoke about the fact we shouldn't, it feels a bit more like a trophy, but we shouldn't, Chelsea can't be a club that views it as a trophy. So I think what he's done there means it looked upon with a lot of respect. I think the thing with Solskjaer is he's done the same with the kids coming through. You know, Brandon Williams has done well, of course. Mason Greenwood's been absolutely brilliant. It feels like there's a little bit more of an inconsistency. Every time United seem to be picking up a head of steam, they seem to suddenly hit a roadblock. And I think that's what they need to lose a little bit. But I still think he's done a good job. I think it's been a long time coming. It's been a messy job to take over in the first place. And it was always going to take quite a bit of building. What you can't forget is that Lampard did take over a team that won the Europa League last year as well. So he had a good squad.
Chelsea have already dipped into the transfer market this summer for the new season, signing Hakim Ziyech and Timo Werner. There is also talk of Kai Havertz joining as well. Gregor, do they need Havertz as well? And if they don't, where else should they be strengthening?
Do they need Havertz? I mean, probably when you look at their squad, that's where they're best stocked, are these kind of players
who are
really
top heavy, aren't they?
Yeah, talented players kind of that play between the lines or wingers. But I think the thing with Havertz is the feeling is he's a kind of a generational talent. If they can't get him, then I think they should. But that does not detract from the fact that they need to strengthen defensive, definitely. And obviously the goalkeeper situation, Kepa was left out at the weekend. And I think it looks like Lampard will do his best to try and move him on. I'm not sure that'll be easy because he's earning a lot of money and he was the most expensive goalkeeper. And they also need definitely at least one centre-half and they need a left-back. So I think all these things are known. I think what's been really interesting about about Lampard's season is that there's been a group of people who've been really keen to put him on a pedestal and say what an outstanding job he's done. And there's been another group of people who've been kind of quite keen to say, well, hang on a minute, he's inherited a very good squad. It's a bit of an easy thing to hide behind that there was a transfer ban and he was bringing through some of the best kids in the country. And I think there is kind of a middle ground. I think he has done, there's no doubt he deserves great credit for getting the club into the Champions League and also in the FA Cup final. But at the same time, there are still some, as Tom alluded to, there are some kind of issues with them. Chelsea are very open sometimes, and tactically, there have been a few missteps this season. So, look, he's new in management, but it's been a very, very encouraging start. And Chelsea look far better placed than they did this time last year.
Is that your cat, Gregor?
She just wandered in. I just had to absolutely shoo her out there. Sorry.
But what about Manchester United then, Tom? The return from lockdown has shown that Ole has formed a strong starting 11. Are they limited beyond that with their depth? Or is there some exciting young talent?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely fair to say that it's a strong 11 and they miss a bit of depth. I mean, you compare it to the other benches in the sort of traditional top six, and it's definitely weaker. Chelsea yesterday had Tammy Abraham, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Pedro, and Callum Hudson-Odoi on the bench. I think Tottenham, considering Jose Mourinho was speaking of before the lockdown about his lack of depth on the bench, he had Bergwijn on the bench and Dele Alli. So I think it's certainly weaker. So I think they do need to strengthen. Where I think would be probably one of the positions they've been most strongest this year. I think maybe or in the past years is the goalkeeper's a big issue there as well as at Chelsea. Obviously that can be resolved by Dean Henderson coming back. I also think Bruno Fernandes coming through has been a huge sort of solution to the problems that Ollie's had. But I think they haven't really solved the defensive side of midfield. I think Matic has been good in fits and starts this season. He turns 32 on Saturday, and he's been a brilliant player in the Premier League, and Scott McTominay shows he could become that player. But they haven't got a player like a Wilfred Ndidi or a Kante who allows the other players to have more freedom. I think they're well stocked in those attacking positions, like Gregor was referring to with Kai Havertz. Like Chelsea, they've got a lot of players in attacking positions. But I think they lack a little bit of a kind of centre forward. I think it's just part of the building process, and I think this will be a big summer for them. And of course, to get the Champions League was huge. There was even talk today of immediately discussions between Dortmund and United happening over Sancho. I don't think that's quite correct yet, but it just goes to show, you know, suddenly it shows how important getting the Champions League position was, because it makes them such a hugely more attractive.
Obviously, Tom mentioned David De Gea there as an issue perhaps for Manchester United. Gregor, you've mentioned Kepa as well at Chelsea. When both of these players, Gregor, or should I call you Blofeld with your cat?
No.
When both of these keepers command such huge salaries, how difficult would it be to move them on when you consider the financial climate that football may well find itself for the next year or so?
Well, this is the context for all of these discussions. You know, we don't really know actually how the transfer market is going to kind of react this summer. It's quite condensed, and second of all, obviously there are huge pressures, financial pressures on clubs, even the biggest clubs. So part of that is going to be whether clubs are A, willing to spend the money, but whether clubs are willing to accept bids for them that are likely to be a lot lower than their outlay. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be very hard, and also it's going to be hard for these top Premier League clubs, because they pay better money than the majority of clubs in Europe. So it could be difficult for them, yeah. But I think really that was a bit of a statement from Frank Lampard yesterday. You know, he's been left out before, but he was left out in a game that was deciding their fate for the next season, whether they got in the Champions League or not. It wasn't like a cup game or a game in the middle of the season. This was a crucial fixture for them, and they left out a goalkeeper who cost north of £50 million.
And Tom, you were mentioning there about the position of Manchester United and whether they need to strengthen. There have been earlier this season question marks over Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager. It seems to be vindicated now when you consider where they've ended up. Do you think therefore he has, well, it's been justified now that he will be able to spend money, that he will be given the resources because of the work that he's been able to do with Manchester United and turn them around since the turn of the year?
Yeah, I mean, definitely sort of deserves to. I mean, there's been question marks ever since he sort of came in, hasn't there? And I think the thing is, you could kind of play devil's advocate for a little bit, for the moment on this, where this is a team who were struggling along throughout the season. It's only been since restart that they've recorded three wins in a row in the league, and this is Man United. And I think what it kind of goes to show is how you can't underestimate the influence the signing of Bruno Fernandes has had. Because he came in January, and I believe that since he joined, the form table has United at the top. I mean, it was a landmark signing. And I think it's someone who United have been after for a while, and I don't think it's someone who, you know, just Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was the man shouting from the top of Old Trafford for him. I think it's been one that was going for a while. The other side of it is that it's part of this building process where maybe he was a crucial piece of the puzzle of what Solskjaer was pulling together there, that they are shifting, and that just accelerated the process greatly. I mean, what they've done now is, referring to earlier, the fact they're in the Champions League will mean that players of his calibre can be attracted so much more easily. And playing in a team with Bruno Fernandes, playing in the Champions League with Manchester United will be huge and attractive for any player now. The only thing, of course, I think which is worth noting is that it's 7 years now since United won the Premier League, and when you think of someone like, say, a Jadon Sancho and the connection there is there, he would have been 13, I think, at the time, the last time Man United won the league. So there's almost this kind of movement in generations. How, you know, we've been around a little bit, so we still look at Man United as this huge club, and they are. But the players coming through and the prospects like Erling Haaland, who of course they're in for, it's how they view the club.
Yeah, no, good point there, Tom. I think we should just have a quick word on Leicester, Gregor, because obviously it all seemed to be going quite well for them at one stage, and while it's credible that they have earned themselves a Europa League place, as many perhaps hadn't tipped them for the top four, there's going to be huge disappointment, isn't there, around the club at how they've actually let it slip away, when you consider that at one stage they were 14 points clear of Manchester United in February. They've been in the top four since late August and only dropped out last week. So what had been an exciting possible 10 months has just ended in one huge anticlimax.
Brendan Rodgers obviously tried to put a different spin on things afterwards. He was saying it was the club's second best Premier League finish, I think, and after obviously their title winning season. But it's hard to put a positive spin on a kind of a fall that, you know, two halves to the season almost that kind of contrasting. That was the fascinating thing actually about the whole kind of weekend. It was, you know, this was a season where it was kind of, we began the season thinking, you know, Chelsea have got a rookie manager and a transfer ban. Manchester United have got Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager. Liverpool and City will run away with it. But this is a year of kind of the insurgent, a Wolves, a Sheffield United, a Leicester can gatecrash the party here. And then 352 days later and 38 games later, it was close, but no, I'm afraid not. But it was as you were. The four richest clubs in the country are the top four again. There is that, you know. You have to say Leicester are still Leicester City, and they don't have anything like the resources of those other clubs. But there's no doubt that after the start, you know, we were talking about them as title contenders briefly. after the first half of the season they had, it's going to be a huge disappointment for them.
Yeah, well, at one stage, as you rightly say, they were pushing Liverpool, weren't they? But it seemed to all fall away. Now, like the battle for the remaining top four places, three teams began the day fighting for one remaining Premier League place. Just 3 points separated Aston Villa, Watford and Bournemouth heading into the final day. And it was Dean Smith's side that came out on top. It is Villa then that lived to fight another day in England's top flight, led by boyhood Villa fan Dean Smith. And fittingly, another boyhood Villa fan scored their goal in the 1-1 draw with West Ham on Sunday, which secured their stay in the Premier League. And of course, I'm talking about the captain, Jack Grealish. So, Tom, can Aston Villa fans hold any hope of keeping hold of their star man, Grealish?
No. next question.
Really?
Sorry, I'm being facetious.
I think most, if they had gone down, I think most would have accepted that he was going to leave. But now that they are going to stick around for at least another season, there's no hope that he'll still be there?
No, I think exactly. You're exactly right. I think that is the slight chance, Nat, that means that he could end up sticking around, because it also depends on who comes in for him now, because, you know, Villa are still a Premier League club. They're his boyhood club. He's clearly got a strong connection with the team and especially with Dean Smith. So if they had gone down, there would have been that kind of desperation, I suspect, to still be a part of the Premier League. Now that that's still there at Villa Park, I think it would kind of need to be a really big club for him to go, and the difficulty there is who comes in for him. I mean, there's talk of Man United. Again, we've just been discussing about how much kind of depth they have in similar positions. I could see him at a Mourinho Spurs team, really, that kind of that individual talent that he has. But no, like I say, I was being facetious. There is a small chance that he could end up sticking around there, but he's just such an outstanding talent. I think the issue is whether teams like a Liverpool and a City, where they have a real model and an identity, whether they can get Grealish to fit in with that, kind of assimilate him into that, because at the moment he's that talisman where it's these individual moments of brilliance that save his team and have him create this status that he has now.
Where do you stand on it then, Gregor, with Jack Grealish? Can you see him moving on to, I don't know, one of the top four clubs from this season?
I think part of it starts with what we were mentioning before about the kind of how much Villa would expect for him and the kind of financial climate. So that might affect things. I'm also not entirely sure which top four club he gets in. He kind of walks into the starting 11 for us. It's a lot of money to, you know, to lay out for a bit of a kind of maverick, unique player who you're not entirely sure, as Tom says, he doesn't really fit into the kind of dynamic of a modern team. So I'm not entirely sure about that. You know, I think Spurs probably are the most likely, but he'd have a lot of defensive duties under in a Jose Mourinho team. It's a question mark about that. So no, I'm certainly not Chelsea, not with the money they're throwing around at the moment and the talent they have available to them. Mm. I think it'd be difficult. So in that sense, then I think there's a chance he will stay at Villa.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, especially when you talk about the top four, I mean, you can't think of him fitting into Liverpool. You can't think of him at Manchester City. Chelsea, as you say, they're recruiting already, and doesn't seem that they need someone like Grealish. And it seems as though Manchester United would be the only club that he may go to. But again, it's a question of does he fit into life at Old Trafford. So if we're talking about Aston Villa and Grealish, Tom, is it imperative they keep hold of him to ensure that they have a better next season?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we've seen the impact he's had. I mean, Villa don't stay up without him. There's no chance that they get, as in this season just gone, they would not have stayed up without him. So for them, it is. I think it does feel like there's possibly a bit of an exception that he might go there, or he would go if the right offer came in. I mean, you only need to listen to Dean Smith talking this morning about the celebrations last night and joking about writing his new contract in tequila, wasn't it? Or vodka shots.
Zambucas. I think it was Zambuca
shots. He is crucial to them. I think at the same time, I do think Dean Smith was kind of right what he said yesterday, in that this Villa team was sort of muddled, not muddled together, but pulled together very quickly last year for a lot of money in a short amount of space of time. And then they had to kind of mould and gel throughout a season where they were suffering injuries, and they were also one of the weaker teams in the division. And then morale goes. So you're kind of trying to build a unity within all of that. So, and I think that is slightly coming together now. They looked a hell of a lot better after the restart. And a lot of that was because of Grealish, but it was elsewhere as well. So I think they just would need to reinvest the money well.
And what about the job that Dean Smith has done in his first season managing in the Premier League, Gregor? When you also consider the amount of money that Villa spent, has he done a good job?
It's a strange one to gauge, actually, because, you know, they did spend a lot of money, and I don't think it was spent all that well on the whole. I'm not sure you can just lay that at the feet of Dean Smith.
No.
They were on an awful run. I think they lost some like eight of the 10 games before these last four, and they won two of the last four to stay in the league. And the big part of that was, as Tom said, after the restart, they just looked much more solid defensively. You know, they conceded a couple of goals in the last four games, which was, you know, after the shipping four against Leicester and even more against Man City a couple of times, was a big turnaround. So I think that, you know, just, yes, Grealish is the talisman, and he's the man who got the vital goals when they did win points. But it was also work on the training ground, it seems like, that has really kind of shored things up at the back and given them a chance to survive, which is what they've done. But Dean Smith, yeah, I think he now has a chance to make more additions, to try and mould his squad a little better. And as you say, there was a lot of turnaround in numbers last summer. So he's got a little bit of time to try and work on a plan for keeping them in the league next season now.
Well, with Villa surviving, it sealed the fate of Bournemouth and Watford, who will be joining Norwich in the Championship next season. After 5 years in the Premier League, the Cherries will be playing in the second tier of English football. After the game, Eddie Howe looked emotional. So could we have seen Eddie Howe in the dugout for Bournemouth for the last time, Tom?
Quite possibly. Yeah, I think quite possibly. I mean, he's always been a very measured manager, and as you say, he was very emotional yesterday, but even in that, he was pretty measured in saying that, you know, his future is something for later in the summer. I guess he wasn't going to make any knee-jerk decisions after seeing Bournemouth go down, because, you know, this isn't similar to the other clubs. This isn't Daniel Farke's Norwich going down, or even Hayden Mullins as an interim manager, or any of the managers who've been there before him, because Howard taken them, you know, everyone knows the story. It's the famous fairy tale story now coming up through the divisions. And of course, it's the long affiliation that he's had with the club. I think this summer it will be a case of personal ambition up against his kind of heart in a way, because of that connection. I don't think he'd want to leave Bournemouth at all. We've seen that before. He had opportunities in the past to leave, and I don't think there's any manager in the Premier League now who has a connection to his club more than Howe does with Bournemouth. But I worry for Bournemouth if he did go, because he's probably also one of the only managers in the Premier League who still has that kind of traditional position of a manager, where he has his fingers in absolutely everything going on at that club.
So where, Gregor, would you say Eddie Howe's stock is right now? As Tom just alluded to, he was a name that not so long ago was linked with some high profile jobs, Arsenal, Everton, England. But where is he at right now?
Well, he's not there. I don't think, as Tom said, like, personal ambition will come into his decision, actually. I think it'll be about whether he feels Bournemouth he's going to be in a position to help Bournemouth return to the Premier League. And that's going to be dependent on what players they can keep hold of, whether they have investment. You know, money is tight there. I think, you know, Bournemouth have spent a lot of money to stay in the Premier League, and when they drop out and the TV money dries up, then they're back to having, you know, between 10 and 15,000 fans through the gate every week, and it's a small club. So, you know, there's going to be some tough decisions to be made there. So I think it won't be about personal ambition. It'll be about whether he thinks, A, whether he feels he can leave on these terms after such a journey, whether he can live with himself almost to leave on a kind of a failure of a note like this. And also whether he thinks that Bournemouth will be in a position to challenge to return to the Premier League next season.
Tom, they'd made a good start to the season in which I think they'd only lost three of their first 11 games, but their form sort of seemed to nosedive after that. There were obviously some key injuries to players, and then obviously with the restart, we know what happened with Ryan Fraser, who's been such an influential player for them, in particular when you think back to last season. I think he was second on the list for most assists in the Premier League, but very different this time around, as we know what happened with Ryan Fraser not wanting to play on and finish things off for Bournemouth. Can you see where he could possibly end up, Eddie Howe, now, should he part company with Bournemouth?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a really good point Gregor made about the fact it would be such a sour note to leave on. His legacy at the club ends with a relegation. The only thing, though, I think is that I think his name would still be in amongst the big clubs. Maybe not the top six, but I still think he'd be just outside that. I mean, if you saw Brendan Rodgers, if you saw that kind of, sorry, cliched managerial merry-go-round going on this summer or any time soon, with like Brendan Rodgers leaving Leicester or say a Nuno leaving Wolves, I do think his name would be in there because of what he's done at Bournemouth. I think because of the run, especially through the end of just before lockdown and then the beginning of the restart, it was just a horrible run. I mean, I think it was seven defeats in eight that really killed them a little bit. Suddenly there's a few sort of knee-jerk assessments of him and his kind of performance and whether it all comes to the end of the road. But like you said, Nat, there's been kind of a horrible storm there of the injury to David Brooks. I mean, he was such a key player, and to lose him for practically the whole season, the Ryan Bennett situation with his contract. And then, you know, injuries with Nathan Aki as well. He was missing for a while as well. And I do think, though, at the same time, the job he did with that club is now it's over. The job he did with that club will be considered a kind of almost a miracle for getting there. And I think that will be taken into account.
Well, Watford arrived in the Premier League at the same time as Bournemouth, and they'll be leaving at the same time. After 5 years, managerless Watford will be playing Championship football as well. They fought hard to turn things around against Arsenal after going 3-0 down, but they could only drag it back to 3-2. Two defeats in two for Hayden Mullins in caretaker charge of the club. Gregor, do you really think he could take on the role full-time next season, or do you expect the Pozzo family to be looking elsewhere?
I'd be hugely surprised if he was a manager next season. Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, they cast their net far and wide, Pozzo's, when they're recruiting managers, and I don't think somebody who's kind of unproven like Hayden Mullins is the kind of person that they're really going to be going for. I just think, again, it's worth saying how ludicrous it was to sack Nigel Pearson. It just remarkable, the idea that it feels like a kind of emotional, personal decision got in the way of the best interests of Watford Football Club. You know, it sounds like they had a disagreement, and you know, we said last week that Nigel Pearson's not a shrinking violet. He probably said his piece, and you know, but this is it's an emotional industry, and to sack him with two games to go, and the idea that Hayden Mullins would have a better would get more from the players, or there'd be a better opportunity of Watford surviving with Hayden Mullins in the dugout than Nigel Pearson, was frankly ludicrous. So I think Watford actually are getting what they deserve here.
When a club is continuously changing managers, as Watford seem to do, Tom, is that an excuse for this relegation? Or actually, do the players need to put their hands up and say they're at fault for some of this as well?
I think it's a bit of both, in a way. Gregor very nicely summed up the situation at Watford. I mean, they've been there, the Pozzos have been there since 2012. And again, it was their approach is brutal. The amount of managers, I think they went through 10 in the first 6 years. The approach is absolutely brutal. And it's an unforgiving environment to work in. And I think this season that approach ran out a little bit. I mean, you had Javi Gracia last summer. He'd taken them to an FA Cup final. He was the first Watford manager, first of all, to survive a summer and second of all, to get a contract extension. And then 5 games into the season, he's gone. And I think the Pozzo's next move, more than sacking Pearson, the Pozzo's next move was the big mistake, and that was going back to Kike Sanchez Flores. Not because he's incapable or a bad manager. I think the opposite of both things. I think he's a very good manager, and he showed that in 2015 when he was at Vicarage Road for the first time. I think the problem was what that represented, and that was a backward step, and it was shown in the fact that they missed the bounce that they obviously hoped for. And by the time Pearson did come in, it wasn't necessarily too late, but where the amount of points that he collected on average for over a whole season would leave a team, a club, mid-table, and they're not. So I think if they brought him in earlier, with hindsight, obviously, wonderful thing, but with hindsight, if they brought in Pearson earlier and not gone backwards, I think they would still be a Premier League club.
The managerial situation has been a revolving door at Watford for a very long time, as you've just pointed out, Tom, when the Pozzo family took over. Gregor, what is it like to be at a club when you're changing managers? And also, I suppose in some ways you want to say the Watford players, a vast majority of them, would have been used to it. So in a way, you felt like they were perfectly suited to a change in managerial positions there. But how much of an effect does it really have on you when you keep having a new boss at the helm in a short space of time?
Thankfully, I never had 4 in one season, so I can't really...
Really? I can't believe that.
I can't emphasise that. But I think it must become wearying. I think actually when, you know, the whole bringing back Kike was one thing, at least they knew him. A lot of them knew him. It didn't work out, but the noises around Pearson from the players like was all hugely positive. I think just the fact that he was honest. He said it how it is. You know, there's no grey areas with him, and it was refreshing. I think actually Ben Foster used that word. He said it's been refreshing him coming in, and they wanted him to stay. So I think you know, that was a good move, and it was one that a lot of people questioned. A lot of people looked at that and thought, you know, Nigel Pearson, really? That's, you know, that was a surprise. But it was a good move. And the way that they kind of shot themselves in the foot after that was just remarkable. So I think for the players, you know, look, you asked as well, the players do take a good portion of the blame here, because 4 managers have never been able to rouse a consistent level of performance from them in the same way that they have in previous seasons, and that is down to the players who go onto the pitch. But it's hugely disruptive when you've you know, when every few months a new manager's in the door with different ideas and a different approach. I think it must be hugely tiresome for the players, and I'm not surprised to hear someone like Troy Deeney saying that he was basically saying, come and get me, wasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly was doing that. We'll talk about Troy Deeney in just a moment. But just lastly, on the managerial situation, Tom, we've had Gracia, we've had Flores, we've had Pearson, and then we've had Mullins for the last 2 games. If there's a manager looking on at the situation at Watford, why would they want to take this when they know that their job isn't necessarily secure?
I still think many managers would take it because of the fact we all do know the kind of context. I don't think any less of Kike Sanchez Flores for getting sacked. I don't think any less of Nigel Pearson for getting sacked. I think they would both be in contention for jobs in England now. I think Nigel Pearson comes out of this very strongly, and like Gregor said, it was a shrewd, surprising move to bring him in the first place. I remember going to Pearson's opening press conference, and he admitted the kind of surprise of getting the job and being back in the Premier League because of his controversial history within it. Now, I think a lot of Premier League clubs will look at him, especially when we get to sort of December time and those first sackings come and you're looking for a manager to come in and save a club. I think Pearson will be among it. But sorry, I'm segueing a little bit. With Watford, I think it's still a big club. It's got a brilliant fan base. At the moment, it has a great squad still. And I think you just need to go into it with your eyes wide, wide open, knowing that you may not be there that long, but it's still a brilliant job.
You mentioned the good squad there, and Gregor, you obviously suggested that Troy Deeney's future may now lie away from Watford. He was pretty emotional after the game, admitting that he's not entirely sure where his future lies. Would there be a number of Premier League clubs interested in his final few years?
Look, Troy Deeney's a handful for any defender, any Premier League defence. I think I'd be surprised if he's not still playing in the Premier League next season. You know, he's a big character too. It would take the right manager to want to take him on board. But you know, someone like Crystal Palace, Newcastle, even, yeah, Burnley. He'd fit in very well at Burnley. You know, I think he's definitely still cut out for the Premier League, even though he's 32. And I think he let an interviewer know that after the game as well.
Yeah, very politely.
Yeah, not very politely. No, yeah. I mean, again, it's just about. I think the one thing to say is if he wants out, he'll probably get his way. So I think the likelihood is we'll probably still see Troy Deeney in the Premier League next season.
So it is Norwich, Bournemouth and Watford who will all be playing in the Championship next season. Who's the best equipped, do you think, Tom, to bounce straight back?
It's a hard one to answer in terms of you just don't know what's going to happen this summer. But right this second, the way the teams all went down, I'd say Bournemouth. So the reason that I think they still have a very good squad and I think they still have a very good manager. I'm not sure he'll be there next year, like we've just said. I'm a little bit concerned about how that club could sort of be stripped apart with their best players. And it's the same thing with Watford. I think you'll get Premier League clubs dipping into their kind of best players. So maybe the answer might end up being Norwich because they came up with a similar squad to the one they had. They accepted that what they were doing, that they weren't investing hugely, and they go down with the similar squad, same manager. I don't think the going down was as hugely disheartening as it will have been to Bournemouth and also Watford.
Mm. It certainly felt like Norwich were preparing for relegation. Gregor, what about you? Who do you think could return and make immediate return to the Premier League?
I think it's almost ironic, but it probably is Norwich because mm-hmm. they've probably got the best chance of keeping their squad together. There's a few players, Max Ahrens, possibly Cantwell, who I'm sure will have some interest. But also the fact that they lost 10 games in a row just before to go down. So, you know, they'll have a task on their hands sort of transforming the atmosphere in the place there. But they're a well-run football club, and I think, you know, this was their whole idea. They want to be in the top 26 teams in the country, not just kind of push the boat out or you know, overspend to maintain their status in the Premier League every year. If they go down, they want to be someone who's challenging to come back straight away. Bournemouth, I think, will be picked apart like a carcass. I think Nathan Ake will go, David Brooks will go, Callum Wilson will go, Josh King will possibly go. So I think Bournemouth could be in serious trouble with or without Eddie Howe, really. Mm-hmm. And Watford, you know, for all the chopping and changing they've done, they have a lot of experience, the Potsells. They've owned football clubs for, I think, at least 2 decades in as many as 3 countries. So I think Watford probably will be up there next season.
Are you just mentioning Norwich, Gregor, because you so badly predicted they'd stay up, so you're hoping that they'll come good?
Well, if we went all the way back to a year ago to my predictions, I think maybe Norwich were going down, but I've been pretty bad on them recently, haven't I?
Not the best, but anyhow, it's been a strange season, shall we just say that? It's been a strange season, and the longest, of course, a Premier League campaign has ever lasted due to a global pandemic. Liverpool were made to wait, but after already waiting 30 years, a few more months was nothing, really. Klopp's side finished on 99 points, breaking bundles of records and setting an even higher standard in the Premier League. Manchester City, Manchester United and Chelsea completed the top four, and there's every chance they'll all be pushed Liverpool next season, perhaps. Unfortunately, at the bottom, the Premier League says goodbye, as we've heard, to Norwich, Bournemouth and Watford. They'll all be looking to bounce straight back. But after what we saw in the Championship on the final day, well, they're in for some ride, that's for sure. So after almost one whole year of Premier League moments, it's probably time for both Gregor and Tom for you to pick your favourite moments of the season. So, Tom, have you got one for us?
Am I only allowed one, am I? Oh, no.
Well, no, no. You start with your top one and then let's see where we go.
Don't use mine.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'll just go for two. So the goal line technology problem at Villa Park for the opening game of the restart just stood out to me as, you know, you've had 3 months out. You've had all this kind of desperation, everyone talking about coming back and actually having a debate about VAR again. And then suddenly this happens in the first game back. It just seemed too ludicrous to be true. But my top moment of the season has to be the Pochettino sacking at Spurs. And the reason is not necessarily actually kind of the Pochettino being sacked, because I think we felt it coming for quite a while, and I think there was this I don't think Pochettino wanted to be there anymore. But it was the decision that came after that, this marriage of Daniel Levy and Jose Mourinho, and this overnight shift at Tottenham Hotspur between a club that was playing beautiful football under Pochettino and elevating young players and making them better, to Mourinho, who was pretty much the antithesis of that. And it was just a huge shift in focus of a football club that I don't think we've seen in a long, long time, and I don't think we'll see for a while.
I mean, by the way you spoke, Gregor, I'm assuming that maybe the Pochettino sacking is one of your moments, but are you still surprised, actually, both of you, that Maurizio Pochettino is still not in a job?
A little bit. I think James Gearbrand actually wrote a really cracking piece on Saturday about, he was almost arguing that he should go back to Espanyol, who've been relegated to the second tier in Spain, because he was talking about how Pochettino, you know, he needs something more than just, you know, if Paris Saint-Germain threw millions and millions and millions of pounds at him and said, come and be our manager. I think he's someone who's quite an emotional guy who needs to feel an attachment and a love and a kind of a yearning to be there. You know, I think that probably is part of it. Part of it also was that, you know, there was the whole kind of courting of Real Madrid, and now Zinedine Zidane has won the league there, so that's not going to happen. You know, a lot of the big jobs that looked like they were going to become available suddenly aren't. So it could be something that's a little bit more imaginative for him now. Obviously, Juventus have been linked as well, but they've just won the league under Sarri. So, yeah, I mean, I am surprised, but at the same time, I think, as James argued, if anyone's not read that, I would urge them to, you know, he's someone who's an emotional guy and you know, he's a disciple of Bielsa, and he's kind of, he needs to feel that the job is something that he could throw his heart and soul into. So that's possibly why he's waiting. But that was one moment for me that leapt out. It was just the sheer shock. I just remember sitting at home and seeing on Sky Sports News, like, within the space of about 45 minutes, there was like Sky sources say that Mourinho is being linked, and then like half an hour later, Mourinho is in talks, and then it was like 20 minutes later, Mourinho to be announced in the morning. It was like, what? Yeah. I just could not believe it. So yeah, that is a remarkable moment. On the pitch, I think Liverpool, Man City, the 3-1 game back in November, when I think Liverpool were 6 points clear at the time, but that kind of, that had everything. That was probably the game of the season for me, and also memorable for Pep Guardiola's absolute kind of mind loss on the touchline when he was throwing two fingers up going twice to the to the fourth official. When I think it was it two handballs in the build-up to the goal, something like that. So that was probably on the pitch. That was, although I have to say Xhaka as well. Xhaka's kind of meltdown and fallout with the Arsenal fans, that kind of, that really represented how much turmoil and how toxic the Emirates was at that time. And I don't say that because I'm a kind of sadist and I enjoyed watching him being abused. It was really horrible to watch, but it's actually remarkable to see the kind of turnaround he's enacted there. You know, since Arteta's come, he's become quite an important player for them. So you'd have thought there was no chance he was ever going to play for Arsenal again. And suddenly he's performing well for them. So those two things. And I don't know how we can't mention as well the weekend that it all stopped. You know, when we found out that if Mikel Arteta hadn't tested positive for COVID, then there would have been another round of fixtures. And just that, just thinking back to that weekend and how kind of frightful it was and how the world came kind of to a standstill, the football world came, you know, there was bigger things at play, but that was a really, that was a kind of a moment that you'll always remember in a season that is, has been unique.
Certainly has been that, and I think we all can agree that we don't want to obviously experience another indeed season like this as well. That is it for now. Thank you to Tom and to Gregor as well. We're going to be back with you on Thursday, but in the meantime, make sure you subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for award-winning journalism on every platform. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. Do stay safe.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.